Chapter 2. Of the battle fought last Friday between the ancient and the modern books in St. James Library. Whoever examines, with due circumspection, into the annual records of time, will find it remarked that war is the child of pride, and pride the daughter of riches. The former of which assertions may be soon granted, but one can not so easily subscribe to the latter. For pride is nearly related to beggary and want, either by father or mother, and sometimes by both. And, to speak naturally, it very seldom happens among men to fall out when all have enough. Invasions usually traveling from north to south, that is to say, from poverty to plenty. The most ancient and natural grounds of quarrels are lust and avarice, which, though we may allow to be brethren, or collateral branches of pride, are certainly the issues of want. For, to speak in the phrase of writers upon politics, we may observe in the Republic of Dogs, which in its original seems to be an institution of the many, that the whole state is ever in the profoundest peace after a full meal, and that civil broils arise among them, when it happens for one great bone to be seized on by some leading dog, who either divides it among the few, and then it falls to an oligarchy, or keeps it to himself, and then it runs up to a tyranny. The same reasoning also holds place among them in those dissensions we behold upon a turgescency in any of their females. For the right of possession lying in common, it being impossible to establish a property in so delicate a case, jealousies and suspicions do so abound, that the whole commonwealth of that street is reduced to a manifest state of war, of every citizen against every citizen, till some one of more courage, conduct, or fortune than the rest seizes and enjoys the prize. Upon which naturally arises plenty of heart burning, and envy, and snarling against the happy dog. Again, if we look upon any of these republics engaged in a foreign war, either of invasion or defense, we shall find the same reasoning will serve as to the grounds and occasions of each, and that poverty or want, in some degree or other, whether real or in opinion, which makes no alteration in the case, has a great share, as well as pride, on the part of the aggressor. Now whoever will please to take this scheme, and either reduce, or adapt it to an intellectual state or commonwealth of learning, will soon discover the first ground of disagreement between the two great parties at this time in arms, and may form just conclusions upon the merits of either cause. But the issue or events of this war are not so easy to conjecture at. For the present quarrel is so inflamed by the warm heads of either faction, and the pretensions somewhere or other so exorbitant, as not to admit the least overtures of accommodation. This quarrel first began, as I have heard it affirmed by an old dweller in the neighborhood, about a small spot of ground, lying and being upon one of the two tops of the hill Parnassus, the highest and largest of which had, it seems, been time out of mind in quiet possession of certain tenants, called the ancients, and the other was held by the moderns. But these disliking their present station, sent certain ambassadors to the ancients, complaining of a great nuisance, how the height of that part of Parnassus quite spoiled the prospect of theirs, especially towards the east, and therefore, to avoid a war, offered them the choice of this alternative, either that the ancients would please to remove themselves and their effects down to the lower summit, which the moderns would graciously surrender to them, and advance into their place, or else the said ancients will give leave to the moderns to come with shovels and mattocks, and level the said hill as low as they shall think it convenient. To which the ancients made answer, how little they expected such a message as this from a colony whom they had admitted, out of their own free grace, to so near a neighborhood. That, as to their own seat, they were aborigines of it, and therefore to talk with them of a removal or surrender was a language they did not understand. That if the height of the hill on their side shortened the prospect of the moderns, it was a disadvantage they could not help, but desired them to consider whether that injury, if it be any, were not largely recompensed by the shade and shelter it afforded them. That as to the leveling or digging down, it was either folly or ignorance to propose it, if they did or did not know how that side of the hill was an entire rock, which would break their tools and hearts, without any damage to itself. That they would therefore advise the moderns rather to raise their own side of the hill than dream of pulling down that of the ancients, to the former of which they would not only give license, but also largely contribute. All this was rejected by the moderns with much indignation, who still insisted upon one of the two expedients, and so this difference broke out into a long and obstinate war, maintained on the one part by resolution, and by the courage of certain leaders and allies, but, on the other, by the greatness of their number, upon all defeats affording continual recruits. In this quarrel whole rivulets of ink have been exhausted, and the virulence of both parties enormously augmented. Now, it must be here understood, that ink is the great missive weapon in all battles of the learned, which, conveyed through a sort of engine called a quill, infinite numbers of these are darted at the enemy by the valiant on each side, with equal skill and violence, as if it were an engagement of porcupines. This malignant liquor was compounded, by the engineer who invented it, of two ingredients, which are gall and copperas. By its bitterness and venom to suit, in some degree, as well as to foment, the genius of the combatants. And as the Grecians, after an engagement, when they could not agree about the victory, were wont to set up trophies on both sides, the beaten party being content to be at the same expense, to keep itself in countenance, a laudable and ancient custom, happily revived of late in the art of war, so the learned, after a sharp and bloody dispute, do, on both sides, hang out their trophies to whichever comes by the worst. These trophies have largely inscribed on them the merits of the cause, a full impartial account of such a battle, and how the victory fell clearly to the party that set them up. They are known to the world under several names, as disputes, arguments, rejoinders, brief considerations, answers, replies, remarks, reflections, objections, confutations. For a very few days they are fixed up all in public places, either by themselves or their representatives, for passengers to gaze at, whence the chiefest and largest are removed to certain magazines they call libraries, there to remain in a quarter purposely assigned them, and thenceforth begin to be called books of controversy. In these books, is wonderfully instilled, and preserved the spirit of each warrior, while he is alive, and after his death his soul transmigrates thither to inform them. This, at least, is the more common opinion. But I believe it is with libraries, as with other cemeteries, where some philosophers affirm that a certain spirit, which they call brutum hominis, hovers over the monument, till the body is corrupted, and turns to dust or to worms, but then vanishes or dissolves. So, we may say, a restless spirit haunts over every book, till dust or worms have seized upon it, which to some may happen in a few days, but to others later dash, and therefore, books of controversy being, of all others, haunted by the most disorderly spirits, have always been confined in a separate lodge from the rest, and for fear of a mutual violence against each other, it was thought prudent by our ancestors to bind them to the piece with strong iron chains. Of which invention the original occasion was this. When the works of Scotus first came out, they were carried to a certain library, and had lodgings appointed them, but this author was no sooner settled than he went to visit his master Aristotle, and there both concerted together, to seize Plato by main force, and turn him out from his ancient station among the divines, where he had peaceably dwelt near 800 years. The attempt succeeded, and the two usurpers have reigned ever since in his stead. But, to maintain quiet for the future, it was decreed that all polemics of the larger size should be held fast with a chain. By this expedient, the public peace of libraries might certainly have been preserved, if a new species of controversial books had not arisen of late years, instinct with a more malignant spirit, from the war above mentioned between the learned about the higher summit of Parnassus. When these books were first admitted into the public libraries, I remember to have said, upon occasion, to several persons concerned, how I was sure they would create broils wherever they came, unless a world of care were taken, and therefore I advised that the champions of each side should be coupled together, or otherwise mixed, that, like the blending of contrary poisons, their malignity might be employed among themselves. And it seems I was neither an ill prophet nor an ill counselor, for it was nothing else but the neglect of this caution which gave occasion to the terrible fight that happened on Friday last between the ancient and modern books in the king's library. Now, because the talk of this battle is so fresh in everybody's mouth, and the expectation of the town so great to be informed in the particulars, I, being possessed of all qualifications requisite in an historian, and retained by neither party, have resolved to comply with the urgent importunity of my friends, by writing down a full impartial account thereof. The guardian of the regal library, a person of great valor, but chiefly renowned for his humanity, had been a fierce champion for the moderns, and, in an engagement upon Parnassus, had vowed with his own hands to knock down two of the ancient chiefs who guarded a small pass on the superior rock, but, endeavoring to climb up, was cruelly obstructed by his own unhappy weight and tendency towards his center, a quality to which those of the modern party are extremely subject. For, being light-headed, they have, in speculation, a wonderful agility, and conceive nothing too high for them to mount, but, in reducing to practice, discover a mighty pressure about their posteriors and their heels. Having thus failed in his design, the disappointed champion bore a cruel rancor to the ancients, which he resolved to gratify, by showing all marks of his favor to the books of their adversaries, and lodging them in the fairest apartments. When, at the same time, whatever book had the boldness to own itself for an advocate of the ancients, was buried alive in some obscure corner, and threatened, upon the least displeasure, to be turned out of doors. Besides, it so happened that about this time there was a strange confusion of place among all the books in the library, for which several reasons were assigned. Some imputed it to a great heap of learned dust, which a perverse wind blew off from a shelf of moderns into the keeper's eyes. Others affirmed he had a humor to pick the worms out of the schoolmen, and swallow them fresh and fasting, whereof some fell upon his spleen, and some climbed up into his head, to the great perturbation of both. And lastly, others maintained that, by walking much in the dark about the library, he had quite lost the situation of it out of his head, and therefore, in replacing his books, he was apt to mistake, and clap Descartes next to Aristotle. Poor Plato had got between Hobbes and the seven wise masters, and Virgil was hemmed in with Dryden on one side and Wither on the other. Meanwhile, those books that were advocates for the moderns, chose out one from among them to make a progress through the whole library, examine the number and strength of their party, and concert their affairs. This messenger performed all things very industriously, and brought back with him a list of their forces, in all, 50,000, consisting chiefly of light horse, heavy armed foot, and mercenaries, whereof the foot were in general, but sorely armed and worse clad, their horses large, but extremely out of case and heart. However, some few, by trading among the ancients, had furnished themselves tolerably enough. While things were in this ferment, discord grew extremely high, hot words passed on both sides, and ill blood was plentifully bred. Here a solitary ancient, squeezed up among a whole shelf of moderns, offered fairly to dispute the case, and to prove by manifest reason, that the priority was due to them from long possession, and in regard of their prudence, antiquity, and, above all, their great merits toward the moderns. But these denied the premises, and seemed very much to wonder how the ancients could pretend to insist upon their antiquity, when it was so plain, if they went to, that the moderns were much the more ancient of the two. As for any obligations they owed to the ancients, they renounced them all. "'Tis is true," said they, "we are informed some few of our party have been so mean as to borrow their subsistence from you, but the rest, infinitely the greater number and especially we French and English, were so far from stooping to so base an example that there never passed, till this very hour, six words between us. For our horses were of our own breeding, our arms of our own forging, and our clothes of our own cutting out and sewing. Plato was by chance upon the next shelf, and observing those that spoke to be in the ragged plight mentioned a while ago, their jades lean and foundered, their weapons of rotten wood, their armor rusty, and nothing but rags underneath, he laughed loud, and in his pleasant way swore, by dash, he believed them. Now, the moderns had not proceeded in their late negotiation with secrecy enough to escape the notice of the enemy. For those advocates who had begun the quarrel, by setting first on foot the dispute of precedency, talked so loud of coming to a battle, that Sir William Temple happened to overhear them, and gave immediate intelligence to the ancients, who thereupon drew up their scattered troops together, resolving to act upon the defensive. Upon which, several of the moderns fled over to their party, and among the rest Temple himself. This Temple, having been educated, and long conversed among the ancients, was, of all the moderns, their greatest favorite, and became their greatest champion. Things were at this crisis, when a material accident fell out. For upon the highest corner of a large window, there dwelt a certain spider, swollen up to the first magnitude by the destruction of infinite numbers of flies, whose spoils lay scattered before the gates of his palace, like human bones before the cave of some giant. The avenues to his castle were guarded with turnpikes and palisados, all after the modern way of fortification. After you had passed several courts you came to the center, wherein you might behold the constable himself in his own lodgings, which had windows fronting to each avenue, and ports to sally out upon all occasions of prayer defense. In this mansion he had for some time dwelt in peace and plenty, without danger to his person by swallows from above, or to his palace by brooms from below, when it was the pleasure of fortune to conduct thither a wandering bee, to whose curiosity a broken pane in the glass had discovered itself, and in he went, where, expatiating a while, he at last happened to alight upon one of the outward walls of the spider's citadel, which, yielding to the unequal weight, sunk down to the very foundation. Thrice he endeavored to force his passage, and thrice the center shook. The spider within, feeling the terrible convulsion, supposed at first that nature was approaching to her final dissolution, or else that Beelzebub, with all his legions, was come to revenge the death of many thousands of his subjects whom his enemy had slain and devoured. However, he at length valiantly resolved to issue forth and meet his fate. Meanwhile, the bee had acquitted himself of his toils, and, posted securely at some distance, was employed in cleansing his wings, and disengaging them from the ragged remnants of the cobweb. By this time the spider was adventured out, when, beholding the chasms, the ruins, and dilapidations of his fortress, he was very near at his wit's end. He stormed and swore like a madman, and swelled till he was ready to burst. At length, casting his eye upon the bee, and wisely gathering causes from events, for they know each other by sight, "A plague split you," said he, "is it you, with a vengeance, that have made this litter here? Could not you look before you, and be DD? Do you think I have nothing else to do in the devil's name, but to mend, and repair after you? Un words, friend, said the bee, having now pruned himself, and being disposed to droll, I'll give you my hand and word, to come near your kennel no more. I was never in such a confounded pickle, since I was born. Era, replied the spider, if it were not for breaking an old custom in our family, never to stir abroad against an enemy, I should come and teach you better manners. Pray have patience, said the bee, or you'll spend your substance, and, for aught I see, you may stand in need of it all, towards the repair of your house. Rogue, rogue, replied the spider, yet methinks you should have more respect to a person whom all the world allows to be so much your betters. Why, my troth, said the bee, the comparison will amount to a very good jest, and you will do me a favor, to let me know the reasons, that all the world is pleased to use in, so hopeful a dispute. At this the spider, having swelled himself into the size and posture of a disputant, began his argument in the true spirit of controversy, with resolution to be heartily scurrilous and angry, to urge on his own reasons without the least regard to the answers or objections of his opposite, and fully predetermined in his mind against all conviction. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.